Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
So tonight we are going to tape a live secret ingredient podcast. Is everybody familiar with the secret ingredient podcast? Anyone? So we've been on hiatus for a little bit, and we're coming back strong with an entire season on the Green New Deal, and this will be our inaugural episode. So you are here for in on the entry level. So as we get started, I'm just going to introduce myself and my wonderful co-hosts, and then we're going to talk a little bit about why we're here talking about the Green New Deal, and then jump into it. So I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT, here with the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing, History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, and many, many fantastic articles, one on the Green New Deal and agriculture. Also a professor here in the LBJ School of Public Affairs, Raj Patel. Woo! Woo! And to my left, he is working on a phenomenal book that will change the world very soon, and the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, Mr. Tom Philpott. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me, guys, I'm not used to sitting in the middle, but I'm just going to be doing this all night. Why are we at this point talking about the Green New Deal? Why do an entire episode on the Green New Deal?
And entire season.
Entire season on the Green New Deal. And what is it that is in your background that would bring you to this point?
For those of us listening at home, we're trying to gesture to one another to take this question first, but I'll do it because I'm excited. I mean, look, I've been interested in the food system ever since I occupied my parents' convenience store and lived my childhood surrounded by bad food and sugary snacks and salted things and cigarettes and pornography. And it was in many ways a perfect childhood, but I realize now that maybe it was detrimental to the world that I was hoping to be in. And I'm excited about the Green New Deal because in many ways this is the confluence of everything that I've been caring about all my adult life. I mean, this is a movement that understands climate, that understands inequality, that understands race, that understands colonialism, that embraces history and tries to do something with this moment of crisis. And I don't think it makes sense for us to be talking about anything else other than the climate crisis. And so given that my way into social change is talking about food, because I can start talking about capitalism and people will shut down, but start talking about food and you can recruit. And I think that there's something important about us talking about food and the Green New Deal and systemic change right now, because it's possible and it's imaginable in ways that I've dreamt of my entire life, and now we get to at least have a shot at.
Yeah, and I guess from my perspective, from really my entire adult life, my entire life as someone who looks at and cares about politics, the political trend in the United States has been about unwinding the original New Deal. It's been about paring it back. There's been a massive and sustained right-wing attack against it that began in the 50s and, gained force through the 80s. And in the 80s, there was an inflection point where even the liberals turned against it. And the idea was, that it had to be unwound. The social programs that rose up in the original New Deal, the sort of safety nets and investment in the public sphere, had to be wound down and cut. And the only question was how. And the Republicans wanted to cut it in a more brutal fashion. The Democrats wanted to soften the blow. But sort of neoliberal politics has held sway, basically has controlled the Democratic Party at least since the 1980s. And that's, when I came to political consciousness. And the Green New Deal and the movements, the political currents that have brought it forward are something new on the scene in my lifetime. There was one exception, and that was the Jesse Jackson campaigns of the 1980s, the sort of bold pushback against neoliberalism, defending the New Deal, specifically defending the New Deal's agriculture programs, that galvanized a lot of popular support. Later fizzled out. The Democrats in the 1980s were as upset about and threatened by Jesse Jackson as they are by Bernie Sanders and AOC today. But now, you know, in the 2000s, after the big financial crisis, with the climate crisis looming, there is suddenly this space to talk about not just defending the old New Deal programs, but this bold action that rejects neoliberalism, invests in the public sphere, and takes on climate change with the sort of seriousness that it requires, all in a kind of ethic of social justice, and realizing that there's no solving the climate crisis without a broad-based movement, and there's no broad-based movement without acknowledging the need for social justice. And so that's why I, and you know, Raj and I have been babbling about this since it came out, just how incredibly surprised and excited we are that it's coming to a head now.
And Rebecca, I mean, your interests run from art to Zizek.
This is true.
Why are we talking about the Green New Deal? What's interesting for you?
You know, I'll tell you what. My childhood, in a lot of ways, was a strive for more pornography and a little bit of... But I did have a perfect agricultural setup, which was very interesting. So I grew up in Iowa, and I was detasseling corn when I was 12 years old. I worked on farms my entire childhood. And then when I left home and moved to Europe, I traveled around for a long time and came back and realized, even in the grocery stores, I couldn't find a piece of organic food to buy. It was very difficult to buy the foods that I wanted to eat and wanted to prepare. And I'd realized that a lot of the food that I grew up with and the gardens that I grew up with and the farms that I grew up with were gone completely. And I didn't know really what happened to that. And then through this show, I've come to realize the effects of the agriculture policy in the 80s that I didn't really understand as a child, but really saw a lot of families that I knew suffer quite a lot because of... policies that were put in place by Branstad and others in the 80s. And I'm realizing now that as we have more conversations about the Green New Deal, it's one way into turning the tide in what's happening. And I honestly didn't think that it would be possible. I didn't know the value of the land and the soil in the Midwest, especially in Iowa. And to see it go in such a quick way because of big business, because of greed and capitalism is detrimental to everyone, but it also really hurts my soul. And then, Raj, when you brought up, you know, a way in is talking about food. Well, I can't even talk about the foods that I used to eat and prepare when I was a kid to my kids and have any knowledge or imagination or hope that they will have access to the same foods in the same way unless we do something very quickly and very drastically. So that's why I'm interested in what the Green New Deal has to offer and why I'm very excited about doing this season. Yes.
So we should probably talk about what the Green New Deal is. Over to you, Tom.
Right. So, okay, I'll start this one, but you guys jump in. So basically what it is, I mean, I think that it, you know, on its face, it's a climate plan, but it's so much more than a climate plan. So what it is a realization that the way that climate change is moving, that, and this is sort of the best science we have. This is the IPCC report that brought together all these scientists in the world to... You know, look at all the research and figure out exactly what's going on and how it maps into the future. And what they decided is that if we don't drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions globally within 15 years, then the global temperature, which has already risen 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels, so we've already gotten a degree of warming in place, it's going to hit 1.5 degrees by 2040. And if it hits 1.5 degrees, or if it's, I'm sorry, it's going to surpass 1.5 degrees by 2040. And if that happens, then all of the climate chaos that we've been seeing over the last decade is only going to increase. We're talking about longer and more severe droughts. We're talking about more fierce and destructive storms, like the one that is now looming in the Caribbean, heading to the United States and causing destruction in the Caribbean. We're talking about rising sea levels. We're talking about massive extinction events, and on and on. Everyone knows about this stuff, and the timeline is about 15 years. And so the idea behind the Green New Deal is let's come up with a plan that is as bold as that challenge, that's bold enough to take on that challenge. But let's not do it in a technocratic way. Let's do it in a way that involves the people that will be most affected. And let's do it in a way that can galvanize public support. Because if you tell people climate change is happening, it's going to be disastrous, and you have to sacrifice, you have to give up, you have to, you know, change the way that you live in this dreary way that implies austerity, then you're going nowhere. Your political program is going nowhere. But if you tell people that the way to deal with climate change is to build an entire new energy system, to build an entire new food system, a transportation system, and doing these things will require lots and lots of labor. And that labor could be, there's no reason that labor has to be exploited. And there doesn't need to be a race to the bottom on wages. These could be well-paying jobs that involve a lot of people. Then you're galvanizing support. And then if you also acknowledge that the climate has changed on the backs of poor people, on the backs of indigenous people, and if you acknowledge that and redress those things while you're doing it, then you're building yet more public support. And then it also acknowledges something that I think is extremely important, and that is that the status quo with all of this oil and natural gas trapped in the land, you're talking about trillions of dollars of assets that people own, you're also talking about the agrochemical industry and its pesticides and fertilizers and herbicides. These things generate massive amounts of profits, and if you're going to challenge those industries directly and say that those things have to stay in the ground or in the tank, we can't use them anymore, then they're going to push back really, really hard. And so there's a strategy to get around that, and that is mass mobilization. And we can talk about whether or not that's possible, but that is a theory of change with the New Deal. It is it's coming up with a program that is big and bold enough to take on this challenge of cutting greenhouse gases and doing it in a way that engages and brings in lots and lots of people.
And you know, you brought up the New Deal at the very beginning, which is something that you've talked about before a lot, Raj. Like, and the New Deal, the way it was rolled out, it was a long-term rollout. It wasn't an immediate rollout. Like, talk about the links between the New Deal and the Green New Deal.
Well, I mean, if you read the Green New Deal document, and you should, because it's only 14 pages, and you can Google it. It's House Resolution 109. 14 pages. It's not long, double-spaced. Wide margins. The argument in there is, look, climate change is a thing, but also so is wage stagnation and inequality in America. And because this is an existential security threat, all of a sudden we must, you know, we need to think big. When was the last time America thought big? It was the original New Deal. So the original New Deal is written into this new one. But the original New Deal happened slightly differently from this one. This one writes in a summons for a Green New Deal mobilization. But the original New Deal happened as a result of a mobilization. And it's important to remember that. I mean, now we are surfing an era where people in America have higher approval of unions than we have for, 10 years or something like that. And we've had 20 major strikes that have involved almost 0.1% of the population. 485,000 people have been involved in strikes in the past year. But the original New Deal happened as a result of massive mobilizations. In 1919, over 4 million Americans were on strike. More than 4% of the population was on strike. There were huge mobilizations, and labor power, the power of organized labor was strong. And that organizing wasn't just organizing around, look, we want wages and we want to be treated with dignity, but it was also about, hey, you know, we have an intellectual life and we have visions for the future, and this is what we would like to see. And my worry about the Green New Deal is that the theory of change where the government says you should have a mobilization, you should probably go out and do this. And people are like, yeah, we should probably mobilize, as opposed to the other way around. It's less likely to succeed.
I mean, the only thing I would say to that is that we are seeing mobilization. We're seeing candidates like Bernie Sanders gain traction, and Bernie Sanders is only gaining traction because of mobilization. He was obviously not the favored candidate in the Democratic Party in 2016. He was considered an embarrassment and sort of an eyesore, and yet there he was, mobilizing people, challenging Hillary Clinton, winning some primaries, coming in real close in other primaries. Same with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and that whole aspect of sort of DSA, Democratic Socialists of America style organizing and moving it into the political, into the electoral political realm and running candidates. And, you know, AOC gets a lot of trouble for this, and Justice Democrats for the strategy of primarying sitting Democrats. And the whole idea is that if we don't get these sitting Democrats who are getting all this money from the fossil fuel industry and agribusiness industry out, then we're not going to get a Green New Deal. And so there is this mobilization on the ground that has given us these candidates. And I think whether or not it's going to be enough is, that is a big question. But I do see these glimmers of hope in the electoral sphere from stuff like that.
But do people really know what they're going to be voting for? I mean, is there something to vote for, A? And then, we're going to be going to the polls soon. Like, and listening to a lot of candidates talking about reform and answering questions about what they're for and what they're against. Like, where is the Green New Deal in the political sphere? What are we going to be able to vote on, and how is it going to look? Like, what is the plan around that?
Well, I mean, I think all of us have had our criticisms of the way the Green New Deal was launched and the way it was put together. And I don't know if we can play clip number one.
That would be great.
Here's something we
want. We'll just set this up really quickly, because we have recorded about 4 of the episodes we're going to air in this next season. And so we're going to be hearing tonight just a few of the clips from the episodes that set up kind of what the Green New Deal is and how people are responding to it. Go ahead.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how it is that this thing called the Green New Deal came about.
They want to set up some benchmarks for this is where we need to go. This is the bold direction that we need to go. We need to not shy away from the government playing a major role in trying to solve this problem. And they also wanted to put up some goalposts for members or new candidates running for office.
So that was Ben Lillison of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And we had a very long conversation with him about the international elements of the Green New Deal. Look, one of the criticisms of the Green New Deal is this. If America goes zero carbon tomorrow, the rest of the world, what are they going to do? China will still pollute, and Russia will still pump out its gas, it'll still be a mess. And so, part of the discussion that we were engaging with Ben was, what is it that the Green New Deal encourages us to think about, and what are the ways that America might be a leader rather than a laggard in climate change policy?
Yeah, I think One answer to Rebecca's question is that Bernie Sanders 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, came out with his climate plan, which he's explicitly branding as a Green New Deal. And I believe it's the most explicit. The Green New Deal resolution that Raj was referring to earlier, it was pretty vague. It was a set of goals. And the Bernie plan is a $16 trillion plan that includes food and agriculture, and it includes transportation and lots of stuff in there about labor. And I think it's probably the most explicit expression of what the Green New Deal would look like. But I just want to step back for a second and say that, one thing that you often hear in conventional political conversation is that, why are these people pushing this plan that's going to transform the economy? Isn't it a heavy enough lift to come up with climate legislation? And shouldn't we just, come up with something that, a lot of people, when this came out, when the resolution came out, said, but is it passable? Shouldn't we come out with something that can actually pass Congress? And I just want to turn the clock back one decade. Barack Obama's president, there's a Democratic House. And in 2009, there was actually a close to, I guess maybe it wasn't fully filibuster-proof Senate. I think they had 59 Democratic senators. And there was an effort to pass climate legislation. And I was covering it very closely at the time as a journalist. And it was kind of spellbinding and jaw-dropping to watch it happen because it, and I was covering it from a food perspective mainly. And it goes into the House. And before it even reaches the floor, it's in some committee, before it even reaches the House floor, agriculture emissions. So what the idea of this legislation, it was called the Waxman-Markey legislation, was to cap carbon emissions and then let companies trade the right to pollute. It was called cap and trade. That was the idea. So before it even left this committee, agriculture emissions, which are massive, were completely exempted from the legislation. And the idea was, well, if we challenge the agribusiness, if we challenge agricultural emissions, then we're going to get the agribusiness lobby against us. We better just exempt them immediately. And that didn't work. Agriculture came back and they wanted the sort of Monsantos and Cargills and these companies. What they wanted was they wanted payments for farmers to do exactly what they were doing, the same practices that were emitting all these greenhouse gases. They wanted to sort of engineer it and rig it to get them payments. And so this thing goes through the House. Agriculture is already exempted. It's passed very narrowly. And then it hits the Senate. And the Senate did something that I was just reading about it again today and just shaking my head. John Kerry said, okay, how are we going to get this thing? He's still a senator at this point. How do we get it through the Senate? Immediately in the Senate bill, they negotiate, they put in the language that offshore oil drilling will be expanded on the East Coast and the Gulf, and that also regulations on fracking, which were already very lax, would be reduced still more. So that was the initial move in the Senate. And then it goes around from industry to industry, very much like the negotiations for Obamacare did with the sort of health insurance industry, just sort of getting them on board. They go to the oil industry. What do you want in a climate bill? And the oil industry said, well, we would like to have our emissions exempted. Okay, so they exempted the oil industry. And they go around, heavy industry is exempted. And the final thing was utilities. And utilities were the cap on utilities was watered down. So by the end of this thing in the Senate, you've got agriculture exempted, you've got the oil industry exempted, you've got expanded drilling. You've got this bill that is essentially worth nothing. The social movements around climate change are completely just frustrated and pissed off. There's no social support for it anymore among social movements. And it never even came to a vote in the Senate. This is a democratically controlled Senate. They couldn't get any Republican votes for it. I think even Lindsey Graham, who was for it for a while, even he turned against it. So I think the fate of Waxman-Markey, we should keep in mind when we hear, why don't we do a more conventional approach? Or when we hear Joe Biden say that I'm going to work with some reasonable Republicans and come up with a climate solution. And get back into the Paris Accords, which were, you know, a good thing, but they were very similar to a defanged Waxman-Markey. They basically had no teeth to them. So when we talk about the daunting challenge of the Green New Deal, let's remember that the challenge of a sort of industry-friendly, watered-down climate legislation is just as challenging.
You know, I want to step back for a second because something is really interesting to me about the entire discussion around climate change. One of the things that I think we've been sold in the United States is the idea that we can change the climate by our individual actions. And if we recycle, and if we, you know, are wealthy enough to have solar paneling on our homes, and if we offset our carbon footprint, then we can change this trajectory that's taking us into the underworld very quickly. So that's obviously a lie. And what kills me is the way in which we've embodied this idea of good versus evil in our own selves and what we're doing as individuals. Yet we have no power without legislation to change anything that has to do with a climate right now. I mean, that is a really interesting paradox to be in psychologically.
So are you saying that we should all carry on eating meat and driving Humvees?
Does it matter?
Is that what they're called? I forget.
Does it matter? I mean, the thing that I'm saying is, you know, what power do we have as individuals? Is it really making a difference? Are our individual choices really making a difference? And if so, then why isn't everybody doing that? You know? Why isn't everybody doing the things that we need to do?
Well, for me, for example, I'm an aspirational vegan. I'm vegetarian, but trying to get there. And for me, it's a promissory note in the same way that the Green New Deal is a promissory note. It's a reminder of how it is that you want the world to be without the illusion that merely, not eating meat is going to transform the planet. If everyone didn't eat meat tomorrow, we would still have agribusiness. We'd still have the fossil fuel industry. We would still have vast amounts of inequality and injustice. We'd still be living in a state that fought twice to maintain slavery. So not eating meat, it's great. Local food, it's fantastic. It won't end white supremacy. And I think that it's important to understand that there's only so much power you can get from individual consumer decisions. But the point of an individual consumer decision is all of a sudden a way to reclaim your power against a structure that seems tilted against it. But it's a reminder. It's not a solution. And I think that that's what the Green New Deal offers, is the big picture in a way that merely, buying vegan footwear is insufficient.
So it's a reminder, it's not a solution, but it's also maybe and an ideology. And that's where we have problems around this, right? I mean, it's like when it's an ideology, that's when it's a problem.
Well, I would say only insofar as there are still people, and I guess there are, who live in so much of a bubble that they think that if they have a Prius or an electric car or are a vegan, that everything's sorted out. And I totally agree with Raj that it's wonderful and important to try to make better individual decisions, but it's not sufficient. But if there are people that think that those decisions are that those, you know, the, and if they everyone they know is, you know, what was the quote about? I think it was Pauline Kael in 1968. She said, "I can't believe Nixon won. Everyone I know voted for." I guess it was Humphrey. She was shocked. As long as we live. If you sort of live like that and you think that those decisions are gonna change things, then we have a problem. But I think that if you do those decisions as sort of like as a personal practice, but know that you have to get out in the streets, then I think that it's fine to have an electric car or buy vegan shoes or whatever.
but I do think, you know, the problem with this individual consumption decision issue is this, and I think, you know, the Gilets Jaunes in France kind of get it, where, you know, y'all will have heard of the protests in France, where people not in the center of town but out in the suburbs took to the streets because there had been an increase in the tax on gasoline. And so what they were saying was, look, we can't afford to live in the city. So you make us, you gentrify us out of town, and then you make us pay twice as much as people who are living in town to come back in again, and say it's, you know, progressive because it's fighting climate change. That's not okay. Because we don't have the freedom to be able to choose decent public transit routes and be able to support our family because we've been gentrified and there aren't any public transport options out there. We have to drive, and now you're penalizing us. So you talk about how big our carbon footprint is, but you made it bigger. Now that kind of that kind of assault on the individualized approach, where, you know, if only we just, you know, we all have our little electric cars and pooter around and everything's fine, is to miss the big structural constraints that most of the, and particularly the working class, live under. And I like what I like most about the Green New Deal's sort of 2.0 language. I mean, in when you hear it from Bernie, or when you hear it from other groups that have kind of taken it out into the world and brought it back again and said, oh, we need to emphasize this, is that it's really about jobs. And I wonder if we can play Barbara, clip 3.
I think that would be great. Clip 3.
What's your theory of change that gets us from the Iowa that we have right now to the Iowa that you'd like to see? What's the process for making this transformation happen?
Well, I think I think we should use the power of stories and the power of messaging, but I also think that messaging has to include restoring the vibrancy, and people relate to jobs. I think it has to go back to revitalization. The economic impact of getting people back on the land, diversifying, having things that are people-centered rather than just corporate-centered is what we need to do.
So this is an interesting concept. We asked Barbara, and she runs a farmers activist group in Iowa. What we asked her was, how do you speak to farmers on the ground? I mean, the Green New Deal has been opposed by the AFL-CIO, so it's not a big thing amongst unionists. It perhaps doesn't have the best story or messaging when she's talking to the farmers. But what she's saying is, when you can speak to the farmers and to people on the ground about jobs and how many jobs and this will create, and also what type of revitalization will happen when you're thinking about people, community, people-centered approaches to things as opposed to corporate-centered approaches to things, you have a way that farmers and voters on the ground can respond to a message. And so that was something that I think we really had a hard time in a lot of our conversations. I don't know, it was frustrating for me in a lot of our conversations about the Green New Deal, because it's a lot of big picture stuff, but there wasn't a lot that people could really bite into and grab onto. It's like, how is this going to change my life? If I get behind this, and if it's something that I'm championing and I'm going forward with, how is it going to change my life? How is it going to affect the lives of my children? What am I voting for? And that's what she really was talking about.
Yeah, and I think playing those quotes is a fantastic way to talk about the effect on the food system and food and farming. And one thing that I think everyone on the stage can also attest to, that one of the sort of the main problems with industrial agriculture is that when you go into places where it has really alighted and sort of made itself dominant, places like Iowa, places like the Central Valley of California, Raj has been to many of these places globally. I've been to a couple down in Mexico. One of the things they all have in common, really different topographies, different climates, different crops being grown, is that they all have these economies that essentially push people out. The whole goal of industrial agriculture is efficiency. And the thing is, when you instead of optimizing a system, when you focus on one factor, and that is efficiency, the idea is to basically drive people out. And so industrial agriculture, you do that with fossil fuel powered machines and with chemicals. And so when you go into a small town in Iowa specifically, you know, basically what you're seeing is a town where the economy's been eviscerated, when there aren't enough people anymore to have a school. And so the schools consolidate. People are, you know, with kids are driving miles and miles and miles for school. There's not enough people there for a grocery store. And so they're driving miles and miles for groceries. And then all the jobs associated with these things are also gone. And so you get this sort of feedback loop that ends with a depopulated area and lots of social problems. And so I think one of the ways that the Green New Deal could market itself to farmers and to farm country is that, look, we're realizing that this way of farming, it's so hyper-efficient at producing corn and soybeans, but it's overproducing those things. Your prices are really bad, and there's no jobs in the community anymore. And so if we switch to more diversified systems that are also your efficiency is one of the things you're optimizing for, but it's also things like saving soil, keeping soil in place, making sure that water is clean when it exits the farm. If these become factors in your farming system, what you find is it requires more people, more labor, more skill, and eventually more jobs. And I think that, you know, our Iowa, the woman we interviewed from Iowa about that was exactly right. Like, make this into a jobs bill. And that will resonate in Iowa, because you go to you listen to the Farm Bureau, the sort of big agribusiness lobby. Everything's great in Iowa. But when you go to the ground, everything is not great. There is despair. There is, you know, lots and lots of social problems and drugs and things like that seeping into communities as they flail.
Yeah, one thing that really resonated with me. Who's been to Iowa? Anyone? Have you ridden Ragbri? Indiana?
Close enough.
But Iowa has this bike ride across Iowa. It's called Ragbri, right? And when we were talking to Barbara, we were talking about Ragbri, and it's usually a bike ride that goes from one area of the east to the west. And I've ridden this ride many times, and you stop in each small town, and the town basically feeds you and houses you, and you camp out there, you eat there, and you have kind of a celebration, a little bit of a parade, and then you move on to the next town. And what Barbara was saying was, they can't do this anymore because people can't take the time off to feed. There's no food because people can't take the time off to feed people. They don't have access to local food to sell it and to make money and to feed the bikers who are coming through. So they've had to change the routes. And that, it got me because I thought this was such a huge community building event for all of these towns in and across Iowa. And to not be able to do that now because nobody has the time to leave their job or to travel into the small town to visit with the bikers who are coming through and all of these tourists and to provide them with the local food is really devastating. And so when she just brought up that kind of anecdote about how things are changing, it spoke to me because this has changed within the last 10 years. This is not something that has been going over 50 years and is now gone. This is like 10 years ago, my sister was riding across Iowa and having no trouble finding the parades and no trouble finding the small towns, and now it's gone. And that type of rapid disintegration of the community and the small town should be scary to all of us. But anyway, Raj?
Well, and I'm curious about what y'all think. And when you hear the Green New Deal, what's on your mind? I mean, I think we have a full 15 minutes to engage in. I mean, so what we're doing with the season of The Secret Ingredient is to investigate and do a deep dive into the intersections between the Green New Deal and food. And so if there are things that are on your mind, things that we haven't talked about or things that you feel we've dealt with insufficiently, now would be a great time for us to hear them because we'd then fold it into our programming.
Yes, my name is David, and I was interested in what you guys had to say about one, the recent IPCC report about land use and the impact on agriculture and climate change, as well as my favorite subject, and I know some of yours, which is monopoly power within the agricultural industry.
On monopoly power, it's, I mean, I love it that a lot of the climate, of the rural plans coming from Democratic candidates mention it. It's hard to get farmers of different political persuasions to agree on anything. It's hard to get two farmers to agree on anything. But it's hard. But one of the joys of the consulting process and of the sort of candidacy process is that the monopoly power has surfaced as something that everyone can get behind and find problematic. And so even though the National Farmers Union nationally came out against the Green New Deal, what's been interesting is how many of the smaller sort of state-level chapters have embraced it, and have embraced it at the same time as saying, well, one of the things we like about the Green New Deal is its take on monopoly power, and the particularly with Warren and with Bernie's sort of dual approaches on busting the trusts that govern the operation of the farming industry in the United States. There's been two very big thumbs up, certainly from the progressive farming community that I've been in touch with. Do you want to do the IPCC?
Yeah, and just want to add about the monopoly power is that in addition to being a great rallying point, which I've also observed, it's also a massive impediment because those companies that control various sectors of the food industry, from inputs like seeds and chemicals, the sort of bears of the world, to buying the big meat companies that buy corn and soybeans to feed it to animals, et cetera, the grain trading giants. These companies are essentially harvesting all of the profits from food production. They're sucking them up. They're just a handful of companies in each of these sectors. And they're good, smart capitalists. And they realize that, well, if we're going to protect these markets, if we're going to protect these incredibly lucrative markets, we better invest some of that money in campaign finance and in lobbying. And they're investing, you know, they're in the top 10 biggest industries that are above defense, I think. And so they are going to fight for their prerogative to do what they're doing with the last dollar, and they're already investing massive amounts of money. And I think that the conventional Democrats in the race will mention monopoly power, but there's only a couple of them, and the really convincing ones I think are Warren and Bernie Sanders are actually talking about busting them up. Everyone else is talking about, oh, I'll appoint some, you know, some better regulator, and maybe he'll look at future deals in a better, in a more critical way. But Bernie and Warren are talking about busting up existing agriculture trusts, and that's got to be terrifying to them. On the land, the land use report, I mean, I think that it should be very scary, and also there is some hope there, because one of the things that it talks about is that how there is great potential that is sitting on the table. It's kind of a low-hanging fruit for sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it into soil. And the practices that are prevalent today that sort of, you know, farmers are pushed into doing by these same companies are doing the very opposite thing. The soil sequestration potential of farmland is way higher than what's currently being done. And so we, you know, it's another incentive to switch policies over to make sequestering carbon something that farmers get paid for. And that is actually in those, you know, those ideas, and I think influenced by this new IPCC report, are in both Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren's climate plans. And actually the guy who just dropped out, Jay Inslee, was in his plan as well. So it is starting to percolate, this idea is starting to percolate into the contest, which is great.
Another question?
Hey, so my question is mostly about cynical voters. So you talked about mobilization and how that was important, and voting, obviously. But what would you each say to voters who are cynical about the political landscape?
I mean, voting is the least important part of democracy. It's the icing on the cake. And if you think that voting is all that democracy is about, you know, choosing between Coke and Pepsi, then you're entirely right to be cynical. But it doesn't seem to me that that's what democracy is about, or when it's at its best, or when you feel powerful. I mean, I think that cynicism in the current democratic system is entirely justified if you're districted in an area where it's been gerrymandered and you've got, you know, it doesn't matter that you vote because, you know, there's no point you choosing the politicians because the politicians have already chosen the people. That seems to me an entirely justified reason for cynicism. And yet, I think, you know, one of the things that excites me about the Green New Deal is that it's not just about you. It's not just about whether you vote to change or not. It's about, do we have a planet or don't we? I think this is something that the cynics, you know, the cynics on the left say, well, look, this Green New Deal is nowhere near big enough. It's not going to solve our problems. It just sort of gilds capitalism, but it's still wedded to this idea of perpetual growth. And ultimately, we have to choose between permanent economic growth or a planet. You can't have both. You have to pick one, which all the data suggests is true. So if we choose between a planet or permanent economic growth, what's it going to be? Well, I pick planet. But then how do we get there? We get there through mobilizing. And the voting is, again, a sort of cosmetic moment, an important moment, but it's one of the more superficial parts of becoming powerful again. And I think that in America, in most democracies, most of us don't understand what it is to be powerful because we've been disenfranchised by the state, disenfranchised by capitalism. And part of the promise of the Green New Deal is not in the mobilizing that's mandated by the government, but the mobilizing that we see ourselves. And that's why, you know, things like Extinction Rebellion or the Sunrise Movement or the twinkles of activism that happen increasingly within the labor movement are so exciting. Because that's what democracy looks like, and not voting. And so, you know, I think part of the way of getting underneath that cynicism is, you know, when you're talking about the New Deal, what you have to do is listen and not talk about the New Deal at all and understand where people's cynicism is coming from and what people care about. And as soon as you hear that, you build your message into one that propels you forward through ideas of love. I mean, I'm very quickly just going to tell the story from Bram Ahmadi. Bram Ahmadi is an activist in Oakland who works with something called the People's Community Market. And when he works with at-risk youth and he's interested in people talking about the food system, the first thing he does is not talk about the food system. The first thing is, you know, he says, "Tell me who you love." And people say, "Well, you know, my grandma." "How's she doing?" "She's great." "Is she doing great?" "Well, no, she's not doing great. I mean, you know, she's got diabetes, and then the buses don't come on time. We have to go to dialysis 3 times a week, and they treat us like shit. And you know, and then the checks run out halfway through the month, and we struggle." And all of a sudden, starting with what people care about, the people that people care about, ends up being a very effective way of saying, so what we need to do is organize around improving dialysis. We need to improve the food system. We need to improve transport. We need to improve elder care. We need to improve the pension system. And that's a way of turning cynicism away and using love as a rocket fuel to actually make change. And that is what I think is very hopeful about the Green New Deal, is because it encourages this perspective, not about me versus bloody Ted Cruz, you know, write to your senator. I write to Ted Cruz every day. Does he write back? No. But
sending flowers.
Yeah, no. I'm not feeling the love. But you know, but this is it's about more than that.
Yeah.
Good answer.
I think that's it. I mean, I really do. I feel like, you know, cynicism is very easy to, it's like a virus, you know, like you get this virus of cynicism, and the way to combat it is to think about those things that connect us and those things that are outside of the marketplace that we really value, and to try to go toward that. Go toward the things that give us energy and those things that really build us up. And I think the more that we go toward things like community, or even just, you know, I mean, community dinners, or if you have house parties, or not house parties, that's a wrong word, but like, you know what
why,
I mean.
Why?
I mean, like house parties, house dinners, you know, like when you're talking with a friend, when you remember what it means to be human and to connect and to enjoy time together, that is really combating everything that is valued in a society that says that doesn't matter. And that's not part of the economy, and we can't put a price on it, so it doesn't matter. And getting back to things that you value because they're part of what it means to be human and share in the human experience is really important. And I agree, like, democracy is, you know, sometimes we think that it's about voting, but sometimes we want to be in a situation where we don't have to choose, you know, and sometimes we want to be in a situation where we really want to choose. And I think, like, those two spaces are interesting to think about when we're thinking about where we're at with a society right now. Like, who wants to choose and who wants to have freedom from choice? And if you think about having freedom from choice, then you kind of think, well, what power do I have within this space, within this society? And it's not only about choosing, like, what toilet paper you want, but it's actually about being part of a process where you're deciding what is valuable and what it means to be human and connect with other people.
Yeah, my name is Hannah, and I have a question about the relation between the Waxman-Markey bill and the Green New Deal. And I remember very clearly organizing and marching and then watching with dismay as the Waxman-Markey bill was totally decimated and then died. And conventional wisdom seemed to be that we couldn't pass nationally binding climate legislation as a country, and we also couldn't pass internationally binding climate legislation. I think the silver lining from that was that you saw local and state responses to climate mitigation, but I'm wondering what you think is the solution to not having the Green New Deal just be a flash in the pan or something that dies before it's ever voted on and is never enacted and maybe is a talking point among 2020 presidential candidates, but is never really lived out. So how can we not repeat what happened in the past?
I mean, I think you're asking a really fundamental question. And I think it's also a question about the whole idea of a Bernie Sanders candidacy. And the question is, like, you know, Bernie, you have all these ideas about Medicare for all, the Green New Deal. But when you get, if you become president, you've got this really recalcitrant House and Senate. And how are you ever going to get everything done? And what Bernie says is, well, we're going to have a mass movement. And so you sort of get these images of, you know, like the Vietnam War era protests and the civil rights movement era protests that are just sort of like, you know, I envision Congress people that are like, well, you know, the lobbyists tell me that I had to vote this way, but there are people with pitchforks outside of Capitol Hill. And I think if I want to get out of this building, I better, you know, do the right thing and defy the lobbyists. And I think that is a little bit of a, it's an unanswered question in this. Like, you know, how do we get that kind of mobilization? Raj gave some numbers from his great essay in Jacobin that came out earlier this year that you guys can Google. They just talked about the, you know, sort of lower, you know, minuscule union density now versus the original New Deal. And the question of, do we have the social movement on the ground to get any of this done, or is this going to be a flash in the pan? And I think that that really gets to, you know, I just have two things to say about it. One of those things is that what that tells me is that everyone here, including us on the stage, we really have to be a lot more active. We have to be a lot more on the streets. We have to be mobilizing and galvanizing, because I don't know how we're going to get to that situation where there's like a 500,000 people outside of Capitol Hill demanding that these people, you know, do the right thing on this legislation. And the second thing is that if you look at the Green New Deal, I would be the first to admit that it's a completely pie in the sky kind of, you know, shot in the dark. This has, you know, I'm going to be frank with you guys. This has a pretty low chance of passing. It's got a low chance of ever, you know, passing the House and the Senate and becoming law. And the $16 trillion that Bernie wants to spend, which I think is very necessary, it probably isn't going to happen. But So it's this really remote possibility. The alternative plans that are out there that are less ambitious, that are less up to the moment, because of our political system, they are equally unlikely to pass. And Waxman Markey proves that, that even this completely sort of sold out lobbyist approved legislation has a very, very tiny chance to pass. And so let's go, instead of rallying behind that and, you know, going behind the reasonable center of a candidate who says he's going to work with these responsible Republicans that are going to emerge from the woodwork after Trump leaves. Instead of that, is, I would say, even more pie in the sky than the Bernie Sanders plan. So let's give it a shot. I mean, if the scientists are right, then we have to do something now, and we might as well rally behind something that actually sort of is up to the challenge of the problem. And so, I mean, I think that the question is fantastic, and it really sort of drives home the point that the now I'm going to sound like one of these sort of personal responsibility, you know, drive a Prius kind of a environmentalist, but the answer really is in this room, in our personal choices, but it's not our personal choices whether or not to buy a vegan pair of shoes. It's about whether I'm going to get out in the streets, because that really is that is the Bernie and AOC and Justice Democrats and Sunrise Movement theory of change. And so it's saying that it's sort of assume a massive social movement, and then we can make all this stuff happen. And so we have to become the massive social movement.
Another question?
Hi, my name is Jack, and thank you very much for doing this today. So just in the 2016 election, something that the president got a lot of flack for was the Make America Great Again, right? Kind of hearkening back to a greater past, which probably really didn't exist, but is kind of sold today as like a nostalgic idea of when America was great, right? And so, you know, you notice the Green New Deal is also focusing on a government plan that's, you know, 90 years old or 80 years old. So what do you think about it says about kind of like the heart of American politics or the voter or the people, in that both these places coming from, you know, the super radical right and the, you know, radical left are kind of appealing to the same emotion? You know, what do you think that says about exactly like, you know, the heart of the voter and where American politics is going and how we view the past in a nostalgic sense, or should we be viewing the future in a more positive sense and painting it with the own colors that we have today?
I mean, the bumper sticker that I think attributed to Frederick Jameson, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. That it's easier for us to imagine. I mean, yeah, raise your hands if you can imagine the end of the world and what that looks like. All right, now raise your hands if you can imagine a just economy where we've moved beyond capitalism. No, my students in the middle there, well done. Thank you, comrades. Other than them, I think, you know, a lot of what it is that the Green New Deal is about, and I think, you know, this both explains why it was rushed out so quickly, why it may fail, but why it may persist in the long term, is that it's a stretching of the political imagination that's entirely sclerotic in America. Our imagination about what the government can and should do has been so constrained by decades of the Reagan mantra of, you know, the most terrifying words are I'm from the government and I'm here to help, that we can't imagine a government that does the right thing in our lifetimes. And so, you know, there are these sort of hallowed moments that are misremembered in some ways, to which, you know, we might want to go, you know, to mine for ideas. But I don't think anyone who is using the language of the New Deal wants exactly like something exactly like the old New Deal, because the original New Deal made compromises around race and around gender and obviously around indigenous people's rights, and then propelled forward and created new forms of organizing that really favored agribusiness when we're thinking about food, that no one should romanticize. And I think that there is an openness in the discussions that I've been hearing from certainly from the food and agriculture community to use the idea that government can do something good. Which is, again, an idea that has recently been just called into disrepute, and which has been shown actively to be the case when one thinks of some of the things that are happening on the border, some of the things that are happening with American military interventionism for decades. And to just remind us that it would be possible for the people who we vote into power, who are actually us, who are public servants and we are the public, to do something good in our name. I think part of the reason to harken back to the original New Deal is that that's a time where people can sort of agree, maybe, at least on the left, that maybe there was a time where the government did our bidding. And that's a mark of the atrophying of political imagination. I mean, how bad is it that we have to we have to go back 90 years to remember a time when the government did what we voted for? And so that it seems to me, is the tragedy of needing to call this the Green New Deal, but it's also the opportunity. I mean, I think no one now wants to sell out people of color. No one wants every bit of the Green New Deal is very open to the idea that the United States has done very badly by the 500 plus indigenous nations that continue to constitute the United States. And something needs to be done about that. Similarly, the United States owes a debt overseas for the shit that this country has caused elsewhere. So no one wants a rerun of the New Deal, I don't think. But I think it's just more about how badly damaged our imaginations have become that that's the only thing we can remember that might be good.
Yeah, and I just want to add that one of the ironies of Make America Great Again is that when you sort of peel back the gauze and the sort of, foggy vision of what that means, what is likely being referred to is what economists call the golden age, when wages were rising, when there was a deal between labor and capital, the 1950s and 1960s. And during that time, it is true that people of color were being actively discriminated against and having their heads cracked systematically by the state, not just in the shadows as they are now. But there was this golden age, and that golden age was the original New Deal. And so even Make America Great Again is actually hearkening back to an economic age that was shaped by the original New Deal. And the Green New Deal has got that name, and it's a reference point, the New Deal. But when you look at the documents, when you look at the resolution that we were talking about earlier and the Bernie plan, it is actually very forward thinking. You don't get a lot of New Deal, Roosevelt rhetoric in there. These are very forward thinking documents that are also reckoning with the history that Raj was talking about. So I think there's an important irony there. And it's important to just, note that the Green New Deal rhetoric is forward thinking and not backward thinking.
And I think it's interesting also the way in which we think about the imagination and the past. Like, we think there's this great quote by Danny Kahneman, hindsight is 2020 is the biggest fallacy of mankind. Like, we think that we understand what the past was, and therefore then we can talk about it and package it and put it into an imagined future. But I really think that a lot of it, like the way that the New Deal came out, it was like, there was not a lot of footprints for that there wasn't a lot of imagined future for that when it was coming out. And I think with the Green New Deal, there's not really a lot of imagined future either that we can really grab onto. I do think, as Raj said, it's a crisis of imagination. Like, we are suffering from a crisis of imagination. And I think that if any of us are fully going to confront what the future looks like, I actually don't think that we have language for that. And I think that thinking about things that can change our lives now and how we can act now is really, really important, because I don't think there's time to think about the future. I think we're all kind of in a crisis of imagination.
And with that...
And on that wonderfully sunny note... Well, we have gone past our time, but I would like you to leave us with a little bit of something, maybe Raj and Tom, like You know, we're going into the
always
future.
Always look on the bright side of life.
We have a whole season on the Green New Deal. What are we going to crack? What are people going to get from this season?
We're going to talk about meat and insects. Thank you. And because you know the we're in Texas allegedly, and the it's important to talk about beef and meat and what you know the discussion about meat and the protein system and how that fits into the Green New Deal.
And we'll talk about, I think, a big question for some people. I don't think it's really that big of a question, but how to pay for it? What sort of economics can come to play to pay for a $16 trillion Green New Deal on top of Medicare for All, which I think is also an important sidekick to the Green New Deal. And what else?
And we're going to take advantage of never letting a crisis go to waste. Because what we're going to do is to talk a lot about how to intervene in these discussions. We ask every single person we talk to, how do we intervene? How do we speak to people and so we can change the direction of the conversation and of the imagination and try to desperately not to let the hegemony of destruction and defeat take hold? You think?
And more, and more.
And much more. Stay tuned.
And so, in fact, come back on October the 1st.
October the 1st, we'll be doing another show with a secret ingredient on the Green New Deal and how local actors are involved in the Green New Deal right here in Austin. So thank you all for coming out and for being involved. We really appreciate it. Have a beautiful night.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.